Well, thank you, gentlemen. That was very lovely. Who wrote the song? Who was the author of the song? I know that David Hoover. I'm sorry to ask these questions. Forgive me. When was it written? It sounds like something. Anyway, nice job. Nice job. It's always a pleasure to come before you today on the Sabbath day. With beautiful weather, as Mr. Fish reiterated, like you do, I am sick and tired of my well-meaning friends in Arkansas, Texas, South Carolina, Florida, yada, 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 about California. So I send them pictures of Laguna Beach. I don't hear from them for months. So, no, that's a good question. How many of you are from out of state originally? Yeah. You're welcome. No, I talked to my brother-in-law today. He's in Ohio, and he said, well, tell everybody in your congregation, hello from Ohio. I said, George, half of them are from Ohio. No, it's good to be in. We are so blessed to have such wonderful weather. The subject in preparation for this message and reading, I came across this subject that seemed fascinating, and the amount of material was never ending. The opinion and positions are endless. And it's current, this concept is current today, but began thousands of years ago, as most things do. To introduce it, I need to tell you a story. Becky and my lovely bride and I and the kiddos, because of the career path I was on, I got transferred a lot. I don't know whether it was because I did a good job or they said, we need to get this guy out of here, he's making a mess. So I got transferred, not once, but four times. Not just up and down the state of California, but cross country twice. One of the trips was to our headquarters for the corporation in New Jersey. And it's a beautiful state. We lived there a good 8-9 years. And it was a wonderful experience. But because we were headquarters and we did manufacturing, we had client visits all the time. People wanted to see where the stuff they were buying was made. And it was an impressive tour. This was headquarters. And it was involving precious metals, so you can imagine the security. So after the meetings, the tours, the on and on and on, we would, as is typical in business, we would invite them to dinner. They'd come all the way out from wherever they came. Because we were across the Hudson River in New York City, we had really two popular choices. One was the World Trade Towers at 107 stories each, or Little Italy. Both are obviously, as you may know, in Manhattan. Neither were expensive areas, but the atmosphere was overwhelming, as you can imagine. So, by the way, how many of you have been to Little Italy in New York City? Any of you? A few of you have. Excuse me, I'm talking to you. A couple of you have been. How many have been to the World Trade Center? See? The old one, not the new one. You've been to the old one? Yeah. It was unbelievable. Unbelievable. To quote Jersey. And Becky and I and the kids have been to both places many times. We have very many memories. When we went, we lived in New Jersey. We went, I said to the friends, and they had guys I worked with, and they said, we'd like to take you to New York City, kind of acclimate you. Becky's welcome. I said, no, we'll just go across Hudson. I said, I'll drive. John, you don't drive into New York. You cab, train, and then cab in. I said, I'm from L.A. We're driving. So we drove in, and they enjoyed it. It was always a good joke. But most of the visitors we had were from the Midwest, so 107 stories was just a bit much. So Italian it was. So one night, we're ready to order. We're seated at our table, very nice restaurant, middle of the road, great atmosphere. The maitre d' came to me and grabbed my arm. He said, excuse me, Mr. Scarabetti, I'm making up the name, I don't remember the name. Mr. Scarabetti and his family are in town. You're at his table. You're sitting in his seat. And I said, excuse me, get up. So he grabbed me by my arm, and you can imagine my guess. They said, what's going on? I said, I explained. Well, what do they mean by his table, his seat? I said, well, this is called, apparently we're sitting at what's called the point table. Point table? Yeah, a point table is where the guy can sit against a back wall and he can see everything. You think I'm kidding. I Googled it. This is what came up. quote, based on the context of certain cultural history of the area, begins with an M, in New York City, Little Italy, specifically in the 70s and 80s, I was there in the late 80s, the point table refers to a strategic seating arrangement in restaurants or social clubs used by these people for protection, intimidation, and surveillance. That's what it says. It was typically located near the entrance or in a prime central spot that allowed the senior members to watch everyone entering and leaving. So my guess, they didn't believe him. They said, John, you paid him to do this, didn't you? And I said, I didn't pay anybody to do anything. And they were smiling. I said, is anything going to happen? I said, no, nothing's going to happen. And then I prayed. And nothing ever happened. They had a wonderful time. The areas, as you know, those of you that have been to it, were very, very safe. More of a tourist attraction than anything else. And it's great, great cultural setting. But the stigma was there. The understanding of the environment was there, of turf wars elsewhere in the city, of revenge or vendettas carried out. They were real. Vengeance is a real thing, and it's rooted in a term, lex talionis, which is Latin for law of retaliation. The concept is oddly rooted in Old Testament law. It's mentioned repeatedly in the New, not the word lex talionis, but the concept of retaliation and recompense. Retaliation is all over our society. It permeates everything. If I say Hatfields and McCoys, how many of you know what the Hatfields and McCoys are? Most of you. Do you know that it took 100 years to resolve that family feud about turf wars? Do you know what was over? A dead pig. It lasted over 100 years in West Virginia. Mr. Fish knows about West Virginia, the Hatfields and McCoys, right? Yeah, it's real. This idea, this concept of retaliation. Movies, books, advertisements. In fact, it's everywhere. It's on freeway billboards. As we drove in today, we counted how many? 10 signboards about lawsuit lawyers. 10. We were on the 60 because it rooted us. On the 210, you see them all over. It is amazing. So over the last 2 weeks, I counted this, and just the shows we were watching, they were very middle of the road, family-oriented. I counted 6 to 8 episodes or instances of revenge and retaliation. It is incredible, and it permeates our society. It's a hard subject, this idea of getting even, or just justice. Yeah, right, justice. Justice for who or whom? It is a hard subject, but there is a way out. So today, what I'd like to discuss with you is the biblical concept and true intent, I believe, of God's law and how it applies using Jesus' own words and how we treat one another. The title, it's really catchy, Lex Talionis and Jesus. Let me be clear. I am not analyzing current legal codes. I am not qualified. However, I have watched over 271 Perry Mason episodes many, many times, plus all the made-for-TV movies many times. I do think that does qualify me for some. Okay, I won't go there. And nor am I discussing current business practices, which can become ruthless in American business. Nor am I talking about the NFL, where comeback and vengeance and payback is code word. So as that is a background, nearly all cultures develop a code, a set of protective acts to the group, the family. It is rooted in ancient Near Eastern texts in the Bible, the Law of Hammurabi in 1750 BC, the Code of Ur-Nammu of Samaria, dating to around 2100 BC, used somewhat almost exactly the same language about justice. Turn with me, if you would, to Exodus chapter 21. This, to me, is an absolutely fascinating section, and we're going to hear a phrase you've heard many, many times in your life, and it's out of God's Word. In chapter 21, beginning in verse 22, these are known as the if clauses in God's law. We are reading it, remind yourself of this, we are reading this in English, a specific English translation that you may have, one of 100. It is from the Hebrew, but it's a Hebrew of 1000 AD. So this is a translation into our language. If men fight and hurt a woman, with child, so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished according to the woman's husband and how he imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. To me, this is fascinating. How many of you have heard the phrase, an eye for an eye? We all have. This is where it comes from. It's also repeated, slightly different context, but exactly the same in this eye for eye concept in Leviticus chapter 24 and Deuteronomy 19. The law here is a guide. It's a guide for just recompense, some type of fairness, some type of equality or equity. Restoration, if at all possible, is the goal, not revenge or retaliation to excess. Verse 33 has an interesting, I thought, subsection along these same lines. Verse 33, and if a man opens a pit, or if a man digs a pit and does not cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls in it, the owner of the pit, the Baal is the word in the Hebrew for owner, the master or lord, the lord of the pit. You've heard of the Lord of the Rings? This is the Lord of the pit. He shall make it good. He shall make it good, and he shall give money to the owner, but the dead animal shall be his. It goes on, and if another man's ox hurts another. But the point is, you dig a pit, something bad happens, you've got to make it good. What's interesting is that word good is the word in Hebrew, shalom. It is one of the cognates, or the word shalom, which we know is the word in Hebrew for peace, is a cognate of shalom. Peace. It is peace, to make whole, complete. Make peace. Resolve it. In Exodus chapter 22, if you'll turn there, verse 1, another more if clauses. Chapter 22, verse 1 of Exodus. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall restore the five oxen for an ox and four sheep for a sheep. The thief is found breaking in, and he is struck that he dies. There shall be no guilt for his bloodshed. If the sun has risen on him there, he shall be guilt for bloodshed. Verse 1 is the key verse. If a man steals an ox or sheep, he has to make restitution. That is the intent. Restitution, shalom. It is God's law. It is, we could put it in today's parlance, I look at it this way. The law of the lawnmower. I know the word lawnmower is not there. The law of the lawnmower. If you borrow somebody's lawnmower and it breaks, what do you owe this person? You owe him a lawnmower. Now, if he was with you and it happened, you don't have to owe him a lawnmower. But what you don't get is you don't get 20 lawnmowers if that was your lawnmower that was broken. The guy that broke it doesn't pay you 20 lawnmowers or 30 lawnmowers or 30 million lawnmowers. You get a lawnmower to make peace, restitution. Now, if you meant to steal it and then break it, now we've got a different problem and a different recompense. But again, it's supposed to be along the same issues, a little different, make peace so that both sides are resolved. That's the intent of the law. The law's intent was to make it good and also to give a deterrent. If you knew the certain punishment, you steal somebody's lawnmower and it meant 5 years in jail, is it worth it? It's not worth it. So it's meant to be also a deterrent. But with man and his evil, carnal nature, the intent becomes what? A reason, a justification, or a basis to retaliate. Retaliate means to excess. We want revenge. It is understandable that people want to punish overwhelmingly. It's from a human perspective, and it is wrong. As time went forward, and we find today, as we mentioned, today on TV, on advertisements, everything that we see, constantly we see this issue of you need to retaliate. You need to cover your turf. You need to, and it's to excess, just as everything is today. But in Jesus' day, it was also completely out of hand. And that's a pun, out of hand, remember that, about what we're going to discuss. So please turn with me, if you would, to the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5. When I started to do research on this, I was overwhelmed about the commentaries. One commentary that I have that I use quite a bit, in one of these verses, it took 5 to 6 pages to explain the nuances. It's just too much. Sorry, Matthew. What did I say, Matthew 5? Again, if you get there before me, just start reading. Matthew chapter 5, if you remember, this chapter deals with the Beatitudes, and Christ is the fulfillment of the law. This is verse 17, where he says, "Do not," double negative, "do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets, but to fulfill, to make complete." Jesus gives some very interesting applications relative to what we read about in the Old Testament. So turn toward verse 38, if you would. Chapter 5, verse 38. "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth." This is the section where he goes over and over again, if you remember. "You have heard it said," meaning they knew exactly what he was talking about. Phrase for phrase, word for word. "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whosoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him 2. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away." 4 very simple, very interesting examples. The slap, the cloak, the mile, and the loan. The slap, verse 38. And 39, "Not to resist the evil person, but whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also." Now this section, just for reference, is also recorded in one other place in the book of Luke. It is different. The wording is different. The structure is different. The detail is different. Luke wrote to a different audience. Who did he write to? He wrote to an individual. Remember who it was? Theophilus. Matthew doesn't write to one individual. We think that Luke, in particular, wrote generally to a Greek audience, Matthew to a Jewish audience. That's why he goes into this detail, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. They knew exactly what he was talking about. "But do not resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn your other cheek." Now, Jesus uses the phrase right cheek. That's important. And there's a couple of ways to take these verses. Now, most of you in this room, are you left-handed or right-handed? Right-handed. How many left-handers do we have? Oh, the holy ones. Just a joke. You know what Benjamin means? The phrase Hebrew for Benjamin? Benjamin? Right-handed. Yeah, the left-handers inside of Benjamin were a rarity. Okay, we won't get off on that. But most folks are right-handed. So to slap someone on the right cheek, being left-handed, It doesn't make any sense to me. But when you take your right hand and I slap someone on their right cheek, I must do what? I backhand them. It's a backhanded slap. Now, if you would, I'd like you to turn to your neighbor, take your right hand. I'm kidding. It's just a joke. What did I do? Oh, okay. Is it too hot in here? I'll make it hotter. So to slap someone on your right cheek is dismissive. It's dismissive. It was meant in the time of Jesus for slaves, for children, and class distinction. You're beneath me. Go away. Backhanded slap. Even today, a backhanded slap is what? Dismissive. It's negative. It's insulting. And Jesus, I think, uses this for a reason. The right hand to right cheek is a backhanded slap. In both Roman law and Jewish oral law at the time, the punishment for the type of slap you gave was different, believe it or not. According to the Mishnah, specifically tractate, I know you want to write this down when you get home. You'll look this up. Tractate Bava Kama, 8:6, being slapped with the back of the hand is worse and a higher priority than being slapped with an open palm. We would say, what's the difference? Big difference in that culture. And that's why Jesus uses the reference he does. Being slapped with an open palm this way was dismissive, but not as dismissive. Open palm slap, you incur a fine of 200 zuz, whatever a zuz was. Backhanded slap incurs 400, double the penalty. It was that insulting. In traditional Roman law, under what's called the 12 tables, the interpretation focuses on the element of disgrace and shame with different fines for different acts, different slaps. Jesus' response, give him your left cheek. Verse 38 gives a critical dimension. Do not resist an evil person. Do not stand up and retaliate to an evil person. This person is crazy. Evil means usually borderline crazy. If that's the person, do not retaliate against this person. He's talking about be careful who you retaliate. You shouldn't retaliate to anyone, but these people in particular, they mean harm. Step away. Get out of there. Don't come to a gunfight with a knife. Don't come to the fight at all. Get away. But Jesus means this in a very simple person-to-person aspect. The Princeton Review of Theology comments on this verse this way, quote, Jesus' listeners would have heard this instruction and laughed. What a great way to shame the person who hits you. The joke's on them. Jesus's first audience knew he wasn't telling them to just be nice, but to shame the evildoer. That's the intent here. And insist on being treated as an honorable human being. Go ahead, smack me again. I've got another cheek. The person that did it would know exactly in that culture what was going on. And the blame has been shifted. If it's a hostile situation again, remove yourself. The Bible Project, and thanks to Mr. Fish for looking this up, Tim Mackey, quote, they state, but Jesus is not suggesting that his followers should stand around and take abuse. Remember when Jesus, this is a side issue, when Jesus was slapped, his response. First, turning the left cheek was a bold rejection of the insult itself. Second, it challenged the aggressor to repeat the offense while requiring that they now strike with the palm of the hand, something done not to a lesser, but to an equal. In other words, turning the other cheek strongly declares that the opposer holds no power for condescending shame because the victim's honor is not dependent on human approval. Your conduct is not subject to human approval. It's to God's approval. Again, do not retaliate. Do not retaliate. Next is the tunic. Verse 40. If anyone sues you and takes away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. Why this is important, the tunic was the clothing next to the skin. It was a much, much lighter garment, like almost a sleeping gown. But the cloak was the outer garment, and that kept the person warm, and they often slept in this cloak. It was extremely important. Now, in today's parlance, what's the difference between your shirt and your coat? Well, I can take my coat off and I'm fine. Not in that day. It was a very different, and it had meaning. In fact, this idea, this concept, we won't turn there. I'll just read it to you. It's in Exodus chapter 22, later in that chapter that we referenced earlier. In chapter 22 of Exodus, it says, and this is the New American Standard, quote, if you ever seize your neighbor's cloak, outer garment, as a pledge, you are to return it to him before the sun sets. Why? For that is his only covering. It is his cloak for his body. What else is he to sleep in? Exodus asks. And it will come about that when he cries out to me, I will hear him. For I am gracious. That's how important the cloak and the tunic were in Jesus' day. In offering the cloak as well, the person also would be what? If they've taken your tunic, they've taken it, now all you have is your cloak, and you take your cloak off, what do we call that? Naked. A further humiliation. And the person that knows that when you offer them the cloak, you want to take my tunic, you might as well take my cloak. Take them both. It shifts the entire blame, but do not retaliate. Do not try to get back at them. in the retaliation move. Next is the mile, verse 41. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Jesus' audience knew exactly who they were talking about. There was one group of people, above all others, that were allowed to compel you to walk and carry their equipment, their burden, at least 1 mile. Does anyone know who that is? Somebody say Roman army? The Roman army. A Roman official in Roman law could invoke what is known as angaria, impressment. Soldiers could compel anyone of the local population to carry burdens for a Roman mile, but only 1 mile. That's where we get the Roman mile of 1,000 steps or stadia, the length of walking. You could do it for 1 mile. To ask for to go the extra mile was, and it was meant this impressment was, we're going to show you who bossed. That was a moving experience. It was meant to humiliate, to go the extra mile and say, I'll go two with you. It was meant to shift and to give an attitude and a statement. As with a slap, I'll go you one better. If that's what you really want to do, I'll go you one better. But don't retaliate. Finally, the loan. The loan section of Jesus' examples is a little different than the first three in verse 42. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. The loan. This is more general, and it's somewhat reversed. It's not like the first three. The person asking is in need, probably and hopefully in humility. They need help, some kind of help, and they're asking for it. This is a specialized request, and it's really, you need to know the circumstances. As many of you know, Deuteronomy tells us that loaning can be a blessing, but God's word also says the one who borrows becomes a slave to the one who borrows, and it's true. So it's a very complex subject. My own caution to you is to be cautious. It's better, I think, in many ways. If you want to lose a friend, what can you do? Loan him money. It's better sometimes to just give it. No strings attached. But Jesus uses indeed these first three examples. They're meant to, in the extreme. These are extreme reactions that Jesus gives for and he shifts emphasis. The extreme is overarching examples. He takes the prevailing attitude of revenge, of escalation of retaliation, and shifts the emphasis beyond endless retaliation and brings it to the human level, person to person, brother to brother, sister to sister. Jesus' crowd indeed would understand and probably be smiling at these examples. He was teaching a profound example of law. As we well know in the book of Matthew, especially chapter 5, he was not denying the law. He was expanding it to intent, what the original intent was. He also used something called hyperbole. Hyperbole, as you may know, is a deliberate exaggeration or overstatement used to make a point not to be taken literally, but to highlight a serious spiritual or moral truth. Jesus used hyperbole as a rhetorical device over and over and over again. He did not mean for us to take it literally. Think not? Let me give you a few examples. In Matthew alone. Ever heard of the phrase, camel and the needle? It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. What? In what situation? It's meant as hyperbole. Plucking out the eye and cutting off the hand. By the way, that first reference is Matthew 19. Plucking the eye out and cutting off the hand. If your right eye causes you to sin, take it out. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Guess what chapter? The same chapter we're in, Matthew 5, verse 29. How about the plank and the speck? Remember the plank and the speck example? Make sure you remove the speck in your neighbor's eye and ignore the 2x4 that's 18 feet long in your own eye. Jesus uses these, and one other, straining at gnats and swallowing camels. Jesus had a fondness for camels for some reason. He uses them a lot. They were probably, if you think about it, in his area, they were the biggest living, breathing thing in the area was a camel. straining at gnats, swallowing camels. Matthew 5 again. We are aware of this, that he uses these because he wants to paint a picture. He wants to embed a concept and a teaching that it would be remembered, because indeed it does teach. Camel and needle, plucking out the eye, cutting off the hand, plank and speck, straining at gnats. We remember all these. Did he mean these literally? No, because they're physically impossible. All of them are physically impossible. Well, I mean, I guess you could rip out your eye, but I don't recommend it. But it paints this picture. But Jesus wants us to understand even more of his teaching and how we treat people. And it has to, by extent, how people treat us, how we'd like to be treated. In chapter 5, verse 43, Jesus goes on, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.'" Now that verse is nowhere in the Bible. But Jesus quotes it. We have no idea where he got this. "You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy." In my Bible, obviously it's all in red letter, "You shall love your neighbor" is in italics, which means in my Bible, it's a quote from the Old Testament. "Hate your enemy" is not. We don't understand. The commentaries are pretty consistent in saying we don't know. It's not in Jewish oral law either. The best thing come up with is the Dead Sea Scrolls at Qumran, where that group of people had the sons of light and sons of darkness. And the sons of light hated the sons of darkness. But that's the closest we can get. What's interesting is that he talks about this concept, "I say to you," verse 44, "love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. Then you may be the sons of your Father in heaven, for he makes the sun rise on the evil and on the good, sends the rain on the just and on the unjust." Jesus said, "Love your enemies, bless those who curse you. Do not retaliate. Find a way to resolve the situation that is in front of you. Do not retaliate." I saw a couple of church signs online that I'll pass along. First one is, "Forgive your enemies." This is a sign out in front of a church. "Forgive your enemies. It messes with their heads." And it does. It's been said many times, it is hard to hate someone when you are praying for them. It's hard for you to hate someone. When you pray for understanding and peace and resolution. Another sign that said, this is when Twitter was Twitter. Hang on. "Tweet others the way you wish to be tweeted." I know you'd love that one. I said, this is great. "Tweet others as you wish to be tweeted." Matthew 18, we will not turn there. And Galatians 6 tells us, and I leave this to you for further study. Matthew 18 says, "If someone is overtaken in a fault, especially a brother, what should you do? Take a crowd of people with you and talk to your brother or sister." No, it says, go to them alone. Do that first. Do that first. If it escalates, that's sad. It's really sad. Galatians says the same thing. Go to your brother. Go to your sister that you may resolve it. Galatians 6 says, but also remember what you have come from. Be careful how you speak to them. Remind yourself of your situation and what you've been forgiven of. He says that you may be the sons, the daughters, the children of God the Father. In verse 46, he goes on. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? You're doing what's normal. You love people who love you. Wow, what a wonderful thing you're doing. He says in verse 47, and if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Yeah, I got it. You want to be around your friends. You want to be around people who like you. But if those are the only people you talk to, those are the only people that you relate to, Jesus said, that's sad. You should greet all people, even people that may not like you, may not respect you. You still need to discourse with them. So he says, if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Again, do not even poor tax collectors. Do not even the publicans, the tax collectors, do the same? Therefore, you shall be perfect. That's the objective. You shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. The word perfect there can be translated out of the Greek, complete, whole. It doesn't mean perfect like God the Father is perfect. We will never be perfect as God the Father is perfect. Do you know why? We have a past that we remember. This means to be complete, whole. This verse speaks to God and Jesus Christ's attitude of forgiveness. They were and are forgiving. We forgive other people. Ephesians 4, verse 32, I'll quote it for you. Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other just as Christ in God forgave who? You and me. In Matthew chapter 6 of the model prayer, he says this twice. For if you forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you don't want to forgive other people, not good. Forgive as you have been forgiven. So let's conclude. Today, as in Jesus' day, people, nations, organizations are often consumed, live for revenge, retaliation, their form of justice. But God's law is very clear. Just recompense for injury is warranted to make people whole, to make them complete. Jesus is the lawkeeper, and he asks us to think deeper because we've been given so much to understand. The New Testament is full of these concepts about forgiving, understanding. Can you be angry? Yeah, but sin not. Do not let the sun go down upon your wrath. Again, I reference you to Matthew 18, verse 15, and Galatians 6, verse 1, for your further study if you wish. I leave that with you. But especially when we deal with people, especially as our circle in our life is made of circle, the acquaintances and the people that we know, we have the people maybe that we've worked with or that we know, neighbors. We go in, our friends, inside of that are the church brethren, inside of that is your family. When we deal with people, with friends and brethren, and especially our family, with one another, stand up when you're right. That's okay to do. Don't retaliate, especially excessively. Don't retaliate, but stand up when you're right. Forgive whenever it is possible. Find a way to forgive and to make whole. Make it right if you can, if at all possible. Make it right. Make it good. Seek peace. Treat one another as you wish to be treated is throughout our Bible because it is a part and parcel and central to God's holy law.